Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Boko Haram is suspected in an attack on a Chinese labor camp in Nigeria. And India's Modi and his opposition BJP now rule India politics. I'm Terry Wing in Washington. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan is in Paris with other regional leaders to discuss how to deal with Boko Haram, the Islamist militant group that kidnapped more than 300 Nigerian schoolgirls last month. French President François Hollande is hosting that meeting, which includes the presidents of Nigeria's neighbors, Benin, Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. Representatives from the EU, Britain, and other Western powers are also attending. British Foreign Secretary William Hague says his country is ready to offer Nigeria additional assistance.
The Nigerian security forces have not been well structured for this kind of thing. And this has been shown by the fact that the problem has been getting worse with Boko Haram. So we can help with that. That is why we're offering to embed military advisors with the Nigerian headquarters.
Just hours before leaders gathered for the meeting in Paris, suspected Boko Haram militants launched an attack in a border region of neighboring Cameroon. Local officials say militants raided a Chinese workers' camp in the town of Waza, killing one person. A witness told VOA about 200 gunmen arrived in a convoy of vehicles and began shooting. Hospital officials say at least 13 people were killed and 100 wounded in a fierce fighting in eastern Libya Friday between government forces led by a rogue retired general and Islamist militants. Libyan military officials loyal to retired General Khalifa Haftar fought battles against the Islamist group Ansar al-Sharia and other Islamist militants in the city of Benghazi. Al Arabiya TV reported that several thousand members of Libya's army, navy, and air force joined General Haftar, a former army chief of staff, in Friday's military operation. Benghazi is a stronghold of militias with roots in the rebel brigades that toppled longtime Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Nairobi is still ringing from the memory of the twin bombings that rocked a busy market area in the city yesterday. At least 10 people were killed, another 70 wounded. Police say two improvised explosive devices were detonated in the market near downtown. They say one of the bombs hit a public minibus. India is still buzzing a day after India's longtime ruling National Congress Party was ousted in a national election that instead has shined the light on a new star in Indian politics, Narendra Modi. Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party swept a victory Friday, setting the stage for the Hindu nationalist and economic reformer to become India's next prime minister. Modi, the chief minister of the western state of Gujarat, ran a ruthlessly efficient months-long campaign, spreading his message of hope and revitalization at thousands of rallies around the country. Ultimately, voters overwhelmingly chose his message of change. Outgoing Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has left office. His party has led India for the past 10 years, but had been hit by a series of high-profile corruption scandals, high inflation, and lagging economic growth. U.S. President Barack Obama phoned the incoming Indian Prime Minister Friday and invited him to Washington. White House spokesman Jay Carney echoed the president's sentiments.
Narendra Modi and the BJP on winning a majority of seats in this historic election. Once the government is formed, we look forward to working closely with the Prime Minister and the Cabinet to advance our strong bilateral relationship based on shared democratic values.
Officials say a Lao military plane carrying about 20 people, including high-ranking officials, crashed early Saturday in the northern part of Laos. Deputy Prime Minister Major General Guangche Pichit, who is also the defense minister, has been confirmed dead in the crash. And rescuers in Turkey have begun wrapping up search operations at the site of the country's worst ever coal mine disaster. Death toll from that disaster at 301. That's the latest world news from Washington. You can get the news whenever you want it at our website, voanews.com. I'm Terry Wing, reporting from the VOA News Center in Washington.
Good evening. This is Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
Quite a number of arrests that have been carried out. Investigations are on.
The Nigerian Islamist sect Boko Haram kidnaps 10 Chinese engineers in Cameroon.
Espero principalmente que não haja mais golpe de Estado. Espero a paz, a união, porque com a união...
Student Gabriel Nong says, I hope, first of all, that there won't be any more coups, that there will be peace and unity.
Guinea-Bissau's two presidential hopefuls face a runoff election aimed at returning the country to constitutional rule 2 years after a military coup.
Hit Jazzy says his men are defending the nation against extremist Islamist militias.
And Libyan forces attack Islamist bases in Benghazi. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
The Nigerian Islamic sect Boko Haram has attacked Waza in Cameroon's far north region, kidnapping 10 Chinese engineers and killing one Cameroonian soldier. The attack came shortly before the start of Saturday's summit talks on Boko Haram in Paris. Five heads of state are meeting to map out strategies to fight the militant group. Moki Edward Kinzika reports for VOA from Yaoundé.
An estimated 200 Boko Haram members have attacked the Cameroonian locality of Waza, located only 15 kilometers from Nigeria's Borno State, the base of the violent Islamist group. Cameroonian soldiers have been deployed to the area. The governor of Far North Cameroon, Fonka Awa Augustin, say it is very likely that some of the attackers are still on Cameroonian territory because the military was immediately deployed to the border with Nigeria.
There are quite a number of arrests that have been carried out. Investigations are on.
Fonka Awa added that they had asked for more troops from Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé.
I want to let you know that the authorities in Yaoundé are all looking towards the far north region to ensure that things are stabilized and that Boko Haram, that is searching for a safe ground, does not find one.
Waza is within Cameroon's Waza National Park, a major tourist draw. The park is where a French family of seven was kidnapped last year. Earlier this month, Boko Haram attacked a military post some 60 kilometers from Waza, freeing one of their group detained there and killing a Cameroonian soldier. They also left with ammunition. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Guinea-Bissau's two presidential hopefuls held their final campaign rallies Friday. The country heads to the polls Sunday to vote in a runoff election aimed at returning the country to constitutional rule 2 years after a military coup. VOA's Anne Luke has more from our West Africa Bureau with reporting in Bissau by Lassana Kasama.
Voters in Guinea-Bissau say they have high hopes for this election.
Com essas eleições, espero principalmente que não haja mais golpe de Estado. Espero a paz, a união, porque com a união...
Student Gabriel Nong says, I hope, first of all, that there won't be any more coups, that there will be peace and unity, because she says that is what will develop the country. Stability topped the agenda during campaigning in this country, which has been repeatedly turned upside down by coups, mutinies, and assassinations since the country won its independence from Portugal in 1974. This electoral process has been calm so far. The military intervened the last time Guinea-Bissau tried to elect a president, in April 2012. Soldiers stepped in when it looked like the ex-prime minister and ruling PAIGC party candidate, Carlos Gomez Jr., was going to beat the pro-military ex-president Kumba Yala in the runoff. Neither of those men ran this time. Despite the new faces on the ticket, some analysts warn that the underlying dynamics remained similar to the previous election. A PAIGC candidate, this time Jose Mario Vaz, is once again seen to be in a strong position against a man seen as the military's choice, this time Nuno Gomes Nyabyam. Vaz led the first round with 41% of votes. He is a former finance minister who has also served as mayor of the capital, Bissau. The PAIGC party won a majority in parliament in the first round of voting. At a campaign rally Thursday, Vaz pledged to bring stability. He told the crowd, "We need to get rid of hatred and jealousy. We need to turn the page for this country." He says we need to unite and reconcile to rebuild the country. And we need to put the past behind us. And that, he says, is what you will be doing by voting for me. His opponent, Nyabyam, is the former head of the Civil Aviation Authority. He got 25% of votes in the first round. One of his supporters, Bu Emmanuel, says if Nyabyam wins, then Guinea-Bissau will win. He says Nyabyam wasn't in past governments, so he doesn't have those bad habits that hindered the development of the country. Both candidates have pledged to respect the results. The first round of the election on April 13th saw a record voter turnout of around 80%. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
A Rwandan military court has ruled it's competent to try 14 civilians accused of involvement in terrorism. On Friday, a judge turned away a legal challenge to the court's competence by lawyers for the accused. Nick Long has more for VOA from Kigali.
A trial of 14 civilians and two ex-soldiers restarted at the military tribunal this week after a three-month adjournment. The defendants are charged with belonging to terrorist movements and with involvement in an alleged terrorist campaign last September when grenades exploded in a marketplace and on a street in Kigali a few days before parliamentary elections. The alleged ringleaders of the group were arrested in Uganda last year and extradited to Rwanda. This week, the court has seen video testimony from two of the accused, Joseph Nshimi Yimana and Innocent Kalisa. Nshimi Yimana is accused of bringing the grenades to Kigali from the Democratic Republic of Congo, although prosecutors say the people who actually threw the grenades are still on the run. Kalisa is accused with a co-defendant, Lieutenant Mutabazi, of plotting to assassinate President Paul Kagame aboard a boat on Lake Mahazi in the east of the country. On Friday, defence lawyers challenged the competence of the military court to try most of the defendants who have yet to be called to answer precise charges. One lawyer, Maître Viateur, argued that for all 16 defendants to be tried together, the prosecution must show that the crimes they are charged with took place within a certain time and space. The place where these acts were committed must be specified, he tells the court. If you say it was in Congo and Rwanda and Uganda, you might as well say it was in Australia or in Europe, he argues. But a prosecution lawyer counters that whether the crimes were committed in Rwanda, Uganda or Congo, the essential point was the links between the accused. The defence disputes these alleged links, which it says have not been demonstrated. Before ruling on the defence lawyer's challenge, the court called on each of the accused to state their position. All the civilians except one denied any link with the co-accused ex-soldiers, Mutabazi and Kalisa, and all denied any involvement in terrorism. Several did admit to involvement in a banned political movement, the Rwanda National Congress. This man, a teacher, Simon Pierre Mahirwe, says he does not accept that he should be tried alongside Lieutenant Mutabazi because he does not know Mutabazi and Mutabazi never mentioned him in his testimony. The other defendants echoed that view. But in his ruling, Tribunal President Major Bernard Hategi Kimana upheld the court's competence to try the accused and outlined alleged links between them. He says the conclusion is that the Supreme Military Court has the competence to judge all the accused, and he is pronouncing this in their presence. He further announced that the trial will continue on June the 17th. One of the co-founders of the Rwanda National Congress, General Kayumba Nyamwasa, formerly a senior army commander, is currently in exile in South Africa, where he has survived two attacks by unidentified armed men. Nick Long for VOA News, Kigali.
World Bank Group released a global report titled Voice and Agency, Empowering Women and Girls for Shared Prosperity, that outlines the constraints women and girls face worldwide, from gender-based violence to decision-making. I spoke with the World Bank Group Director for Gender and Development, Jenny Klugman, who noted that despite the improvement in gender equality, women still do not have a voice in making decisions about their own lives.
This report was motivated by the observation that there had been enormous progress in gender equality over time, in particular in terms of improving enrollment at school, improving women's health outcomes, some improvements in economic opportunities, but the gains in terms of women's voice, that is their capacity to participate in decision-making in the community and the public at large, as well as in terms of agency, which is decision-making about whether and how many children to have, being able to own property, being free from violence, had been areas where there was much less progress. So there were areas where we wanted to try and understand what was going on and what could be done.
What were some of the glaring issues on the report that need immediate attention?
I think the findings about violence are really so striking, that one in three women globally have been victims of violence, either sexual or physical abuse, and that the vast majority of this has been at the hands of their husbands or boyfriends. I think that's one that really stands out. The rates of child marriage being so high in many countries, the number of unintended pregnancies, that's pregnancies that women either had wanted to delay or not have at all, number 80 million annually. So there's a whole range of, I think, very striking figures that were uncovered and explored by the report.
Data from 33 developing countries revealed that almost one-third of women lack sexual and reproductive rights. Why does it feel like this issue is not being given the attention it needs by the respective countries and the international community at large?
Well, I think there's a range of constraints. What we do find is that women who are better educated and who are in wealthier households tend to have more access to these rights. And so it's related to, I think, some deep structural issues. It's also related to kind of attitudes and norms which are held within households by women as well as by men about respective rights. And I think in a number of countries, particularly poorer countries, lack of access to services still plays a very important role.
The report builds on the 2012 World Development Report, which focused on several areas pertinent to women's empowerment, freedom from violence, etc., where the recommendations of the 2012 World Development Report met?
Well, the World Development Report, I think, laid an important foundation for the work that we've pursued here with this focus on voice and agency. We're moving in very much the same directions. I think there's a lot more that we know about what works, and we're able to highlight that in the report. So, for example, we did deeper analysis of what works to prevent violence, for example, that programs which involve boys and involve men, which work at the community level, which span longer periods of time, are much more likely to be successful. So that's, I think, a new and encouraging finding. I think the findings that we present around education and the importance of education and the links of that to the prevention of violence, I think, are very important as well. So it's moving along in the same direction, but I think with an accumulation of evidence which allows larger insights.
Based on the report that has been released, is there an action plan?
What we do in the report is to expose problems at the global level and the patterns and disparities across regions, across countries, but to work out what makes sense in any specific context requires a lot more in terms of country-level diagnostic, and we've not yet done that in the report. What we do, I think, very importantly, is lay out strategic directions around the expansion of economic opportunities, of education, social protection programs, and the features and the considerations which need to be taken into account in order to make those effective. But in order to actually undertake the concrete actions, much more is needed at the country level to work out what makes sense, what are the specific constraints, and obviously what are the funding requirements as well.
The World Bank Group Director for Gender and Development, Jenny Klugman. I spoke with her from Washington, D.C.
Le Libyan military forces loyal to a retired general attacked militants in Benghazi Friday. Reports from eastern Libya say army and air force units took part in the strike aimed at the Islamist group Ansar al-Sharia and other Islamist militias. Edward Yerenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Libyan state television showed black smoke rising over Benghazi after government warplanes attacked an Islamist militia base. The report said the targets were bases belonging to Ansar al-Sharia and two other Islamist militia groups, the February 17th Brigade and the Rafala Sahati Brigade. Libya's interim prime minister, Abdullah Thani, resigned last month but is still leading the government in a caretaker capacity. Speaking to reporters after the airstrike, he said all sides, Islamist militias and government military units, must refrain from violence and obey orders from Libya's official military command structure. He says that incidents such as the clashes in Benghazi are preventing the government from restoring order and putting a stop to crime and terrorism there. He called on militia leaders to follow orders from the army's chief of staff and urged all military units and police to oppose outside forces trying to enter Benghazi. Al Arabiya TV reported that several thousand members of Libya's army, navy, and air force joined retired General Khalifa Haftar, a former army chief of staff, in Friday's military operation. The prime minister did not mention the general by name, but warned the Libyan military to disregard orders from anyone involved in what he called a coup attempt. The current Libyan Army Chief of Staff, Abdusalam Jadallah, denied that any government forces were fighting in Benghazi. Jadallah, who is reported to have ties to an Islamist militia himself, told Libyan State TV that revolutionary forces, presumably loyal to him, should oppose outside fighters trying to seize Benghazi. General Haftar's supporters, including Colonel Mohammed Hijazi, told Libyan TV that those in the military who oppose the activities of Islamist militias are trying to restore order to their country. Hijazi says his men are defending the nation against extremist Islamist militias. He says that the militias have been setting off car bombs and killing and massacring innocent people in the name of religion. Hijazi said Islamist militias already are in control of portions of Libyan territory, including Darna, a port city east of Benghazi. Libyan TV reported a top general from the government air force also joined the renegade military operation in Benghazi, using air bases in Tobruk and Drina for bombing runs aimed at militants in Benghazi, Beida, Mirja, Sahat, and Susa. Prime Minister Thani, however, insisted that only one government warplane disobeyed orders and took part in the operation. Unruly militias control large swaths of Libya, provoking sporadic outbursts of violence, chaos, and insecurity. Government officials, military commanders, foreign diplomats, businessmen, and workers have been attacked, kidnapped, and sometimes killed. Jordan's ambassador, held by kidnappers for nearly a month, was released earlier this week. In a related development, Reuters reported Friday that protesters took control of several oil ports in eastern Libya. Separatists belonging to the self-styled regional government of Barka recently returned several ports to government control after a lengthy dispute over oil revenues. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Meanwhile, Libya's health ministry says the death toll from clashes Friday in the eastern city of Benghazi has risen to 43, with more than 130 people wounded. The city was calm Saturday after the ground and air attacks, but the airport remained closed. The government condemned the operation, with Army Chief of Staff denying any army involvement in the fighting. Colonel Mohammed Al Hijazi, one of the general's Tafa's supporters, meanwhile said the operation was defending the nation against extremist Islamist militias.
In the Central African Republic, thousands of people have been displaced by the sectarian violence that is wrecking the country. Boa lies about 450 kilometers west of the nation's capital, Bangui. The town has become a refuge for thousands of people displaced. VOA's Bagasi Kura, who recently spent 2 weeks in the Central African Republic, tells us that for Christians displaced by the conflict, getting enough food to survive is a struggle. Marcus Hutton narrates his report.
People start lining up early. The monthly distribution of food rations by the UN's World Food Program is not a day they would miss. The country's food crisis affects not just those uprooted by the conflict. Displaced or not, everybody who is hungry comes. As the hours pass, the line grows and tensions rise. Soldiers deployed by the African Union mission to the Central African Republic keep the crowds in line. Madeleine Kim Mbusa is among those waiting. She and her family of six children fled their village several weeks ago.
The Seleka killed my whole family. My aunts are gone. I couldn't stay there. That's why I came to Bor.
Michelle Suru Bey is a father of eight. He too has no means to feed his family.
Many things have happened during this crisis. I won't name them all. There's a food crisis. My family and I fled into the bush. I visited them. Some are sick.
Finally, the wait is over. Madeleine's name is called, and she makes her way to the food distribution area. Her rations consist of a 50-kilogram sack of rice, 10 kilos of beans, 2 liters of cooking oil, and 15 packets of nutritional supplements. Just as she is about to leave, Madeleine realizes one of her bags is missing. But with the help of other women, she quickly nabs the thief. Madeleine gets her bag of beans back, but her relief is short-lived. Now, her bottle of cooking oil has been stolen. But Edwige Sanikpi helps Madeleine identify this thief, too.
It's a war here. Men rob us, they don't want us to share, and we women are always the losers.
After a difficult day, Madeleine arrives home with all her rations.
I'm really pleased. If I had this earlier, my children wouldn't have suffered. But I'm happy. I must say, this is my lucky day.
Madeleine says she hopes she'll be able to feed her family for another month. For reporter Bagasi Kura, this is Marcus Harton, Voice of America News, Washington.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 1730 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share the ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Thank you.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And still to come, our Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent, plus a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University.
It's now time for our Saturday music spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Shut up, man. Please, shut up, man. I said, shut up, man. Gao, Kébé, très, très fort. Président de Dieu Moniato, président Patrick Kamara. Yves and Jolie, les boucliers. Boni, du son célèbre japonais. Malou, des bosquets. Brino Bellico Fortanova, Tabeli Bonzenga, DJ Celestino, Champion Joli e Sona, Chuchu Luango,
Kona Balini Kapeba, la 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 la
la la la la Serge Kadilo
Patrick Mouyaya
Alino Chuba, Papi Boloa, Maître CD, Boku Tapongo, Ivi Apomba, Olivier Masoudi. Arlette et Moussa Kansai. Ilanga mamo si simbi Christiana kwa salosi ya sasa Marie Rims kwa firme Majaki watunda Ana maiti di beti kapamba Pax Medina Mamolina nzombo Bebe senzo Erite nini mbu Yonga moke tona Nema gombo gombo Juna mingi na chakumu Bonimbemba, Nadege Teke.
Pierre Lorma Sumi, Nana Lotula, Daddy Kousie, the Golden Boy, Zina Kousou, Ras Bila, je suis le grand. Felita Ison encore et toujours for life. Gas mafina, Swiss mafina. Joko Adel, Manix, Moussaka, Patrick Zola, Iguet Mbaboua, Zebomboyo, Soule Matundu.
C'était maman qui l'est mobima. Et au numéro 9, Samuel Eto. s'en sort, chacun sa vie. L'hypocrisie, la jalousie, elle consort, j'en ai pas envie. L'amour et la haine, la vente de père. La haine et l'amour, quel du haut d'enfer. Toujours un sans l'autre, sans l'une ou l'autre, on ne pénètre. L'autre là, ah, ah, l'autre là, ah, à quoi ça sert? Tout ce que l'on perd, il n'y a rien à faire. La terre est mon repère. Ah, l'autre là, signé mon pas. Maloyo ya ka bena litaka toko motale na makambango bena likolo ah godar mutemona
aise bona misi bina kometa na kobina o kaina benda kanule kona sebelisa goduma
eh petit nana sai sai fisto o kama kozi mopa
aise bona misi.
Martin écran, les grands géants.
Oui, maman, y'a ma toto, signore.
Béa, béa. Walter Mounia, béa, béa. Nico, et Bizibia.
Béa, béa. Nico,
et Bizibia. Béa, béa. Et Diata Baounesse, ma chérie, papa Jonathan. Oh, comment c'est qu'elle a fait,
Solomon. Sorti
Bayaka fleur d'amour, Gofen Kanga.
Voilà la mienne, la nage fouette à la mienne.
Marie-Louise
Mouni. Voilà qui m'a dit qu'on est aboli, rigo aboli. Voilà la mienne, papa, c'est le bébé.
Marie-Louise Mouni. Solo pa kona siota adi sete po balula yo. Les Sandy Maluba Dallas Show.
Yeah, that's Congolese Koffi Olomide, and before that you had Fale Ipupa. And I sincerely hope you enjoy that music coming from Africa. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Take it away, Dr. Nyang.
It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections with the Voice of America on issues relating to U.S. policy towards Africa. Every passing week, I pay great attention to the headlines and see what is happening around the world and how Africa is affected by U.S. policy. This past week, the kidnapping of young girls in Nigeria captured the attention of the world. And suddenly, all those who are looking at American policy towards Africa cannot miss the interest of the media on this development in Nigeria. There are a number of issues to be addressed. One is the question of women's rights. The rights of women in Africa is beginning to capture the attention of women groups in America, people who are very much concerned about civil rights and human rights of women in Africa, and people who are also very much concerned about development and the African condition. So those Africans who are very much concerned about human rights are very much affected by the activities of organizations like Amnesty International, Women Working for Children, and women rights in Africa. And then, of course, the religious groups like the Catholic organizations that are very much concerned. So now, when you are looking at American policy towards Africa, you can see that before the summit of President Obama and the African leaders, human rights for women and women issues are going to be part of the agenda. Whether it is intended or not, the kidnapping of these girls in Nigeria has really focused the attention of many people who are interested in African development, African political change, and African security. So these three issues are coming together, and they are going to be very much debated between now and August. So let me underline 5 points for us to remember with regard to how American policy is going to be affected by these developments in Nigeria. Nigeria is one of the 5 big states in Africa. The former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, went to Africa during her term of office. The women issues were very much influential in terms of her journey towards Africa. And what happened in the Congo was a sad story. Many millions lost their lives. Women were raped in Congo. Unfortunately, the media and policymakers and many people did not pay much attention to what was happening to women in the Congo who were raped. Lo and behold, the capturing of these women by Boko Haram captured more attention than the tragedy of these women in the Congo. When the Secretary of State went to Congo, she came back, she spoke about it, and to my dismay, we didn't have strong reaction to what was happening to these women in the Congo. Now, there is a reason why what is happening in Nigeria is more attractive, likely because Nigeria has better press than the DRC, and the DRC situation is going to benefit from these developments in Nigeria. And this is where terrorism, oil, African politics come together. Now, if the people devote much attention to how American policy is going to be affected by developments in other African countries, what happened with the Boko Haram becomes more important because it deals specifically with terrorism. And terrorism is a big issue. It affects American policy. And that's one reason why the kidnapping of those kids by the Boko Haram draws attention. That's why many of us who address the question of terrorism in Africa draw the parallel between U.S. policy in Africa and U.S. policy towards terrorism in Africa. And this is one of the reasons why the big debate among Nigerians to have American president or not to have American president becomes problematic. And that is one of the reasons why the Nigerian political leadership must pay close attention to how you deal with good governance, transparency, and significant economic development. Good governance, transparency, and human rights, they all come together. This is one of the reasons why, as we move towards the summit with the president, there is going to be a great debate in the United States among women groups, those who are concerned about children, those who are concerned about economic development, those who are concerned about human rights. I expect all these groups that are seriously concerned about women issues, human rights, to begin to organize themselves in preparation for the summit. Seriously, the leadership on the African continent should begin to look at what is happening to the B5. You have a big success for a secessionist movement in South Sudan. The lives of women and children in South Sudan, in Sudan, the North, what is happening in Ethiopia to women and children, what is happening to women and children in DRC, what is happening to women in Nigeria and what's happening in South Africa. And that's the way it is today.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Impuga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Lack of electricity is one of the great obstacles to development in sub-Saharan Africa. Nearly 70% of sub-Saharan Africans, some 600 million people, lack access to electricity, forcing them to spend significant amounts of their income on costly and unhealthy forms of energy, like diesel fuel to run factory generators and smoky and scarce wood for indoor fires for cooking. That is why last summer, President Barack Obama announced Power Africa, an initiative that will significantly increase the number of people with access to electricity in sub-Saharan Africa. Working with governments, international and African businesses, non-governmental organizations and institutions, including the World Bank, the European Union and the African Development Bank, the United States hopes to expand the capacity and reach of existing power grids and build mini-grids and off-grid systems to power Africa. By tapping many potential sources of energy, sun, wind, water, or heat from the Earth's core and Africa's abundant supplies of natural gas, the Power Africa initiative is already increasing power generation across the continent. To date, the U.S. government has committed more than $7 billion in financial support and loan guarantees, as well as coordinated support and expertise of 12 U.S. government agencies. The U.S. Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC, which mobilizes private capital to help solve critical challenges in developing countries, committed $1.5 billion to Power Africa for its first 5 years. The Millennium Challenge Corporation added another billion, and the U.S. Agency for International Development will provide $285 million. Today, Power Africa is set to clear the final hurdle, ratification by the U.S. Congress, where it enjoys strong bipartisan support in both chambers. Once it passes, it will be signed by President Obama. The electricity that allows businesses to flourish, clinics to store vaccines, and students to study long after dark will soon become available to more people living in sub-Saharan Africa. Power Africa will change their world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.